So we're working through Paul's letter to the Philippians, and our passage this morning is the second one that we read, Philippians chapter 3, verse 20, to chapter 4, verse 3. Now, I've referred several times in this series to the conflict in the Philippian church between two of its members, between a woman called Euodia and a woman called Syntyche. And now that we finally reached this morning the passage in Philippians that's actually about that conflict, you might be feeling a touch of anticlimax, because we have here no lurid description of evil stares being exchanged across the aisle at a Sunday morning service, or slanging matches happening in the car park afterwards, or anything like that. Indeed, we go away from this morning's passage none the wiser as to what this conflict is about, who of the two women is the more at fault, etc., etc. I entreat Euodia and I entreat Syntyche to agree in the Lord. I mean, that's hardly earth-shattering stuff, is it? Have we been overplaying this whole situation? Is the conflict between Euodia and Syntyche actually not that big a deal? Well, my answer to that is this conflict is a big deal. Let me give you two reasons why I say that. Reason number one, the time scale involved here. Now remember, Paul hasn't found out about Euodia and Syntyche because he's on the Philippian church's WhatsApp group. He hasn't been joining the church's elders' meetings via Zoom. No, he can only know about it through someone having told him in the good old-fashioned face-to-face way. And that someone then is presumably Epaphroditus, the guy you remember who has brought to Paul a gift from the Philippians, and the guy indeed whom Paul is going to send back to Philippi with this letter. Epaphroditus must have been Paul's informant. Now, think about the implications of that. When Epaphroditus sets off from Philippi to take the gift to Paul, the conflict between Euodia and Syntyche must already be underway. He then travels 800 miles to Rome, his journey slowed presumably by that near-fatal illness that he suffers on the way. He then spends a chunk of time with Paul, long enough at least for him to convalesce. And now he's about to travel 800 miles again back to Philippi. By the time he gets home, goodness knows how long that entire period away from Philippi will have been. And yet this is the thing, Paul expects nothing whatsoever to have changed with respect to Euodia and Syntyche. There's no hint of awkwardness here, is there, that he might just be raking up an old quarrel that's actually been resolved by now. Clearly, he doesn't think there's any chance of it having been resolved, despite all the time that has elapsed. And that indicates then the gravity of this conflict. It's no petty squabble of the kind that flares up explosively, but then blows over with equal suddenness. No, this is entrenched. This rumbles on intractably, week after week, month after month. It's a big deal, all right. And then reason number two for saying that, the exceptional nature of Paul's reference to the conflict. I mean, pastoral issues relating to an individual or to individuals don't often crop up in Paul's letters. Normally, he deals with problems that affect the whole of the church to which he happens to be writing. And when he does mention an issue that relates to an individual or to individuals, he normally ensures anonymity. He withholds names. You think of 1 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 1. A man, he says, a man has his father's wife. Is in a sexual relationship, that is, with his father's wife. Now, he doesn't say it's Dave who sits on the second row from the back. He doesn't say it's Keith who always sings a bit off key. No, just a man. A man. Now, of course, the Corinthians would all know exactly who it was anyway. If absent Paul knew about this sexual relationship, then so you can be sure did they. It didn't make any difference to them whether Paul named him or not. But you see, letters from Paul got circulated around the churches. We know that because Paul talks about it at one point in Colossians 4, verse 16. And so you would get then people in the other churches receiving the letter that had been written originally to the Corinthians and kind of talking about it and saying to each other, whew, that's shocking about Keith in Corinth, isn't it? I remember him from when I visited that church once. I remember him singing a bit off key from everyone else. Having a relationship with his father's wife? Dear me. But you see, Paul spares the man that. He spares him the shame of the entire first century Christian church knowing that he's a pervert. He withholds his name. And you'd expect him to do the same here in Philippians 4. There are other churches in Macedonia. It seems altogether likely that such a special thing as a letter from the Apostle Paul will be shared, at least with those relatively local congregations. And the people in Thessalonica then, and Berea, and elsewhere, they'll shake their heads when they hear these verses being read in their congregations. Euodia and Syntyche, they'll say in disbelief. Those two pillars of that church in Philippi, they've been there for years serving the Lord there. What are they playing at? And remarkably then, Paul doesn't spare these women that. He doesn't preserve their anonymity. He puts their names out there in the public domain. It's a shockingly robust approach that he's taking to this problem. In the first place, mention it in a whole church letter at all, and then in the second place, including the women's very names. Again, it indicates that the conflict certainly is a big deal. And so let's think then, steered by this passage, about conflict. Conflict within the Church of Jesus Christ, and there are three things in particular I want us to notice. First of all, the love that laments conflict. The love that laments conflict. So Paul's approach here, I said just now, is shockingly robust. Is it uncaring? Is he just sick to the back teeth of these quarreling women, and so uncaringly he hangs them out to dry, as we say? Be shamed in Thessalonica and Berea and all the other Macedonian churches that this letter will reach, you silly women. It will serve you right. I absolutely despise you. Is that Paul's stance? Well, no, it's not. Last weekend was the men's and women's finals at Wimbledon. Now, after every match on the main courts at Wimbledon these days, they seem to get out a microphone very quickly and interview the winner. But after a final at Wimbledon, they interview not only the winner, but also the loser. And the interview with the loser is always quite difficult to watch, because inevitably at some point the player's eyes start to moisten, the voice starts to crack, the poor man or woman becomes very emotional. And sure enough, after both of last weekend's finals, that is what happened. Even Novak Djokovic, who always seems like such a machine, doesn't he? Even he couldn't hold it together. And you sense in chapter 4, verse 1 here, that Paul is having one of those moments. That if we could have been there in his prison cell as he dictated this sentence to his scribe, we would have seen his eyes start to moisten. We would have heard his voice start to crack. Paul is emotional here. You sense it in the way that he just heaps up expressions of affection. My brothers, whom I love and long for, my joy and crown, my beloved. And especially, you sense it in his somewhat ungainly repetition. The ESV indeed finds it too ungainly and does a bit of airbrushing, but Paul doesn't say, whom I love, early on in the sentence, and then my beloved at the end of the sentence. It's the same word in both cases. Like a stumbling contestant on the radio program Just a Minute, Paul repeats himself here. But not because he's incompetent. He's every bit as good a wordsmith as Paul Merton and the others who excel on Just a Minute. It's because, as I say, he's emotionally stirred. That's why he does it. His depth of feeling in this moment trumps all concern for literary elegance. And what's causing this depth of feeling? He hasn't just lost the Wimbledon final, so what's causing it? Well, notice that it's as he issues the call to stand firm that he's overcome with emotion. Now, what sort of standing firm does he have in mind? Well, that all depends on how we understand one little word here, the word thus. Stand firm, thus, Paul says. There are two possibilities. Thus could refer backwards. Paul could be saying, stand firm in the way I've just been describing throughout chapter 3. Stand firm in relying on Christ alone for salvation. Alternatively, thus could refer forwards. Paul could be saying, stand firm the way I'm about to describe in the next two verses. Stand firm in being united one with another. So which is it? The ESV editors clearly think that it's the first of those two options, thus refers backwards. Otherwise, they wouldn't put that big white space between verses 1 and 2. However, I think it's the second option. Thus refers forwards. Because Paul has used the verb stand firm already back in chapter 1, verse 27. And there, standing firm was about being united. It wasn't about relying on Christ alone for salvation. It was about being united. And it seems likely then that it's about being united here too. So he's saying then, stand firm the way I'm about to describe in the next two verses. That's what stand firm thus signifies, which means that already in verse 1, he's thinking of Euodia and Syntyche and the breakdown in their relationship. Forget the big white space we have in our ESVs. In verse 1, he's already thinking about Euodia and Syntyche and the breakdown in their relationship. Not false teachers, that's not on his mind now. Not the issue of circumcision, not putting confidence in the flesh. He's finished with that now. He's moved on from that now. It's Euodia and Syntyche that is now on his mind, which means that Euodia and Syntyche and the breakdown in their relationship are the cause of this emotion. He's emotional because of them. He loves them, you see. The affectionate terms there in verse 1 refer at one level to all the Philippian believers, I'm sure. But as I say, Euodia and Syntyche are particularly on his mind now. The affectionate terms refer especially to them. He loves these women. And he's wobbly here then, clumsily repeating his words because he's distressed about their falling out. His love for them laments the conflict. And I think there's a challenge for us here that's a bit different from the obvious one. I guess the obvious challenge when we're talking about conflict in the Church of Jesus Christ is don't get into one. Or perhaps if you are in one, then get out of it. But the challenge of our first point this morning is this. What's your attitude to others' conflicts in the Church of Jesus Christ? Conflicts where you're not one of the warring parties, where you're on the outside. I remember at secondary school, during lunchtime, the message would sometimes whiz around the grapevine that two individuals were having a fight on the field. And everyone would head there as quickly as possible from all quarters of the school. And once there, they would form an excited circle around the combatants, chanting, fight, fight, fight. The pupils of the school, and I'm sure it was the same at most schools up and down the land, there was nothing like a good scrap to brighten up an otherwise dreary school day. Well, if two members of NREC fell out, I suspect we'd all be too refined to charge around the building shouting, fight, 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 fight. But I wonder whether inwardly we might actually feel this is exciting. It spices up boring old church life a bit, doesn't it? Well, the problem with such an attitude is that it displays a catastrophic absence of love. If we love our brothers and sisters in Christ, we cannot enjoy the spectacle of them locked in conflict. Love laments conflict. Because conflict damages, you see. A Christian locked in conflict with another Christian almost certainly is not going to be healthy and doing well in the Christian life. Conflict damages. It distracts. It distracts from prayer. That's what we were singing about just now, isn't it? In William Cooper's hymn. Have you no words? Ah, think again. Words flow apace when you complain and fill your fellow creature's ear with the sad tale of all your care. Were half the breath thus vainly spent to heaven in supplication spent? We get so caught up with our words of bitterness because we're in this conflict that prayer kind of gets sidelined. Not only does it distract from prayer, conflict distracts from service. The guy Paul addresses in verse 3 as a true companion, he's probably not a member of the Philippian church. He's someone temporarily involved in the work. And he needs to be told here, doesn't he, that these women had labored side by side with Paul in the gospel. Because perhaps now, so consumed as they are with the intricacies of their altercation, they're unrecognizable from the women who once labored side by side with Paul in the gospel. Perhaps this guy, true companion, he would hardly believe it when Paul says this to him. When Paul puts him in the same breath as Clement, perhaps Clement is a really active guy in the church, and Paul is putting these two women in the same category as Clement, and true companion is probably thinking, what? They were really that involved in the life of the church? They're not now. Because they've been sidelined by their conflict. But not only does conflict distract from prayer and service, it does something worse. It sours and rots our souls. It sours and rots the souls of those involved in it. It's no coincidence that Paul then, after talking about Euodia and Syntyche, goes on in verse 4, outside of our passage this morning, to talk about joy again, rejoicing in the Lord. Because there's nothing that kills joy like conflict. And so I'm saying then that conflict damages, and so love can never relish conflicts in the church of Jesus Christ. Love laments them. May we have that reaction when we see others fighting and arguing in this church or any other church. It's not enough that we avoid conflicts of our own. Of course we must, and we'll come to that, but we ought to lament the conflicts of others too. Because conflict is bad. Conflict damages. You can't love someone and enjoy the spectacle of them fighting with another Christian. And so that's the first thing, the love that laments conflict. But then notice with me, secondly, the theology that disallows conflict. The theology that disallows conflict. Now that word theology may be a turnoff to some of you. Theology, as far as you're concerned, is a waste of time and energy. Practical Christian living is what it's all about. That's the name of the game. That is what you're into. Well, if you were to explain that to the Apostle Paul, I think he would look at you blankly. He wouldn't understand this separating of those two things as though you can kind of choose one instead of the other, because for him, they are intimately and inextricably related, two sides of the same coin. For him, practical Christian living always flows out of theology. And our passage here is a prime example of that. I mean, you can't get more practical than trying to reconnect two estranged church members. In chapter 4, verses 2 and 3, Paul is properly getting his hands dirty in the raw realities of church life. However, he roots his reconnecting of these women in two pieces of profound theology. In chapter 3, verses 20 and 21, he shows Euodia and Syntyche two weighty truths, which make their falling out incongruous and out of place, the truth of citizenship and the truth of conformity. So first of all, citizenship. It's explicitly mentioned there at the beginning of verse 20. Our citizenship is in heaven. I think it's also in view in chapter 4, verse 3. That reference at the end to names being in the book of life. Citizenship was a huge thing, of course, in Paul's first century world, especially Roman citizenship. And Roman citizenship was an official, verifiable status. When Paul was arrested at one or two points and then dropped in conversation that he was a Roman citizen, that must have been verifiable. They must have been able to prove that he wasn't just making this up in order to get out of a flogging. They had records and registers. They had books carefully documenting the Roman citizenship of these privileged people. And that's the analogy that Paul is making use of there in chapter 4, verse 3. When he says Euodia and Syntyche's names are in the book of life, he's saying they are bona fide citizens of heaven. They are in the register. They're on heaven's database. To use the language of Hebrews 12:23, they are enrolled in heaven. So, the passage begins and ends on this truth then of heavenly citizenship. Now, some of you may dimly recall that we've talked about heavenly citizenship before in this series. It was when we were in chapter 1, verse 27. There in ESV, you get no hint of citizenship. The verse begins, only let your manner of life be worthy. But if you look at the ESV footnote, you'll see that in the Greek, it's only behave as citizens. Only behave as citizens. And you may or may not remember what I said then about this reality, that we Christians are citizens of heaven. It's terribly important, this, because the truth is very frequently misunderstood. When Paul writes, our citizenship is in heaven, what many Christians hear him saying is, we're waiting to go to heaven. Which fits with that other misunderstanding that I talked about a couple of weeks ago in verse 14 of Philippians 3, the upward call of God. And people hear Paul saying there that God is kind of calling us toward heaven, which again is not what he's talking about. And here in chapter 3, verse 20, he's not talking about us waiting to go to heaven. No, Paul tells us precisely what we're waiting for in the very next line, doesn't he? And it's not us going to heaven, it's Christ coming from heaven. That's what we're waiting for. So what is Paul getting at then when he says our citizenship is in heaven? If his point is not we're waiting to go to heaven, what is his point? Well, listen to Tom Wright. He says, if someone in Philippi said we are citizens of Rome, remember Rome, Philippi rather, was a Roman colony, its residents were citizens of Rome. So if someone in Philippi said we are citizens of Rome, they certainly wouldn't mean so we're looking forward to going to live there. Being a colony works the other way round. The last thing the emperors wanted was a whole lot of colonists coming back to Rome. The capital was already overcrowded. No, the task of the Roman citizen in a place like Philippi was to bring Roman culture and rule to northern Greece, to expand Roman influence there. And Tom Wright concludes, the church is a colony of heaven with the responsibility for bringing the life and rule of heaven to bear on earth. That's Paul's point. One day, you see, heaven's culture will entirely take over this earth. The kingdom of the world has become the kingdom of our Lord and of his Christ, it will one day be announced. But we colonists begin the takeover now. In our churches, we provide glimpses already of that day when God's will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Christian churches are these strange places amidst all the sin and depravity of this present evil age, strange places in which a foreign culture prevails, the culture of heaven. And what does that look like? What are the features of this heavenly culture which prevails in Christian churches? Well, there are many, but one of the foremost is love, fellowship, unity. That was Paul's emphasis when he mentioned citizenship back in chapter 1, verse 27, and it's his emphasis again here. He's saying, Euodia and Syntyche, don't you realize you're citizens of heaven? Practicing heaven's values and heaven's lifestyle and heaven's culture here on earth. And that, my friends, disallows conflict. Because conflict is the stuff of this present evil age. It's not the stuff of heaven. I wonder, is that something that we think about? I'm saying being citizens of heaven isn't about future destination, it's about present behavior. That's the emphasis. Do we behave as citizens of heaven? And especially, do we relate to each other in this church in a way that befits our heavenly citizenship? In one of the churches to which Hannah and I used to belong, there was a man from the Isle of Lewis. And this man's name was very Lewisian. And his upbringing and family connections were all very Lewisian. He even had a Lewisian type of ruggedness about his facial appearance. But then he would open his mouth and speak with this most un-Lewisian upper crust English accent. And it just seemed so strange then. This Lewis man didn't speak like a Lewis man. And perhaps you're a heaven man or a heaven woman. But sometimes people wouldn't think it from the way that you speak. And I'm not talking now about accent. I don't know what the accent's like in heaven. I'm talking about content. I'm talking about the way that you speak to and about others in the church. I'm talking about gossip and angry outbursts and recklessly harsh criticisms. It should not be in the Church of Jesus Christ. May we conduct all of our dealings with one another as heaven's citizens. And then the second theological truth, conformity. Conformity. From heaven we await a Saviour, the Lord Jesus Christ, who will transform our lowly body to be like his glorious body by the power that enables him even to subject all things to himself. Wow. What a verse that is, isn't it? So when Christ comes, Paul is saying, whether it's via resurrection because we've already died, or whether it's not via resurrection because we haven't yet died, either way, we are going to be ushered into a bodily existence that is beyond anything we ever knew in this life. In this life, even at our very prime, our bodily existence, Paul says, is lowly. Then it will be glorious. But Paul is more specific than that. Our bodies, he says, are going to be like Christ's glorious body. You may remember I commented in the John series when I was looking at John chapters 18 to 20 a few months ago. I commented that in the case of Jesus, there's a gap, an important gap, between his resurrection and his glorification. For Christians, there'll be no gap. Resurrection and glorification will occur simultaneously. For Jesus, there's a gap. Which means then that in Philippians 3:21, when we read of Christ's glorious body, we're not to think of the Jesus that Mary initially thought was a gardener when she encountered him on that Sunday near the tomb. We're not to think of the Jesus whom the disciples in the fishing boat initially thought was a random stranger having a morning walk on the beach. No, we're to think of the Jesus whom Saul of Tarsus encountered on the road to Damascus. We're to think of the Jesus who was briefly glimpsed in advance by Peter, James, and John on the Mount of Transfiguration. We're to think of a bright, beautiful, unimaginably glorified Jesus. And our bodies are going to be like that body, Paul is saying. What a thought that is. Perhaps you've taken a mound of pills with your breakfast this morning. Perhaps you've got a doctor's appointment lined up for tomorrow. Perhaps you feel like your body is falling apart at the seams. Look ahead, believer, to that day when your bodily existence will be just like Jesus' present bodily existence. The word like there in the ESV, like his glorious body, it's not inaccurate. But it is a bit bland and underwhelming. It's a grand Greek word which Paul uses, which means then having the same form as. The New King James, I think, translates it best, conformed, conformed. So verse 21 is saying then that the great culmination, the great omega point of our salvation is being conformed, having the same form as Christ. Now, hold that thought a moment. Let's go to verse 2, where Paul writes, I entreat Euodia and I entreat Syntyche to agree in the Lord, the ESV has it. But it's literally, and again the New King James gets it right, to have the same mind. I entreat you to have the same mind. It's very similar language to that which Paul has used in the first few verses of chapter 2, which we read earlier on. And I said then, when I was preaching on those verses, that we often assume the same mind to mean the same mind as each other. That's what we assume there in chapter 2, and that's what we assume here in chapter 4. Indeed, that's what the ESV is very explicitly translating it as. So have the same mind as each other, you two women. Agree, have the same mind as one another. I don't think that's what Paul means, either in chapter 2 or here. The same mind means not the same mind as each other, but rather the same mind as Christ. Remember, Paul goes to great lengths there in chapter 2 to describe Christ's mind. His self-humbling, self-emptying, own interest-forgetting mind. And in chapter 2, then, Paul is saying to the Philippians generally, have the same mind as that, as him. And here, in chapter 4, he is saying to Euodia and Syntyche particularly, have the same mind as him, as Christ. Because that would remove this conflict, wouldn't it? Surely we can agree on that. I said earlier, we don't know what this conflict is, what it's about. But despite our ignorance about the details of the conflict, we can say for sure that if both these women determinedly practiced Christ-like humility, the kind of humility Paul has set out in chapter 2, it would be over in a stroke. It would be over in a stroke. Now, this is the thing. By itself, chapter 4, verse 2, I entreat Euodia and I entreat Syntyche to have the same mind as Christ. That just sounds like a nice ideal that, yes, it would be good to aim at. However, when you join chapter 4, verse 2 to chapter 3, verse 20, or chapter 3, verse 21, rather, it suddenly takes on a whole new complexion. Because our entire salvation, you see, is about being conformed to Christ. That's what our hope is focused upon. Our future hope is focused upon being conformed one day, that day when he comes, being conformed to Christ. And people then whose hope is focused upon being conformed to Christ in the future can't possibly be indifferent to Christ-likeness now. Isaac was at a university open day recently, and he was utterly blown away by these fantastic sports facilities that he saw at this university. And I guess that's fair enough, seeing as Isaac does do a lot of sport. But imagine then a sixth former who goes on all the time about going to university and using all the fantastic sports facilities. And yet that boy or that girl never touches the more modest sports facilities presently available at school. He or she instead spends every moment outside of lessons sitting on the sofa playing on the Xbox. There's something fishy about that, isn't there? And it's like that then. When Christians get into conflicts and refuse to practice humility and back down and think beyond their own rights and their own interests, their whole Christianity is oriented towards being like Christ in their bodily existence. And yet they're uninterested in the more modest being like Christ that's presently available. They can't yet be like him in their bodily existence, but they can be like him now in their mindset, in their humility, in not putting themselves first and insisting that they always come out on top. So why aren't they interested in that? If they're heading toward being like Christ in the grandest way, why aren't they interested in being like Christ now in these smaller, more modest ways? It doesn't make sense. And again, should we not feel the challenge of that ourselves this morning? As those whose hope is upon being like Christ in the fullest, most comprehensive sense, we must be like Christ in the ways that are available to us now, which means we can't get into fights and quarrels. Or at least we can't let those get protracted. We must get out of them as quickly as possible and resolve them as quickly as possible. And so I'm saying, let's bring these two weighty areas of theology to bear upon our church life, our relationships with one another, and see how utterly unfitting conflict is. We're citizens of heaven, that place of love and fellowship and unity. And we are those whose whole direction is being conformed to the Lord Jesus Christ. The love that laments conflict, the theology that disallows conflict, and then one very brief thing to close, the ministry that heals conflict. The ministry that heals conflict. It's fascinating, isn't it, that request at the beginning of verse 3 of chapter 4, where Paul asks someone to help. I said it's probably someone who's temporarily involved in the work in Philippi. The main reason for saying that is that companion here, that's almost certainly a nickname. There's no record in any contemporary literature of any person having that name. Companion actually is a bit lame as a translation. It's literally yoke together. And presumably then this person who's nicknamed Yoke Together is nicknamed that because he had the reputation of yoking together often those who were estranged. He was a reconciler. He was a peacemaker. And it's unlikely then that Paul was close enough to any ordinary Philippian church member to be using nicknames about them. It's much more likely that this is someone who is not from Philippi, but someone who has ministered alongside Paul at some point. Someone Paul knows well. One commentator actually makes a very plausible case for this being Luke. I won't go into the arguments now, but whether or not it's Luke, the point I really want you to see here is that Paul very highly regards this guy. Paul very highly regards this guy. True companion, he calls him. True is a word that Paul uses only of two other individuals in the New Testament. Twice he uses it of Timothy, and once he uses it of Titus. This is a guy he regards highly. Which means then that Paul here is not delegating this ministry of healing the conflict between these two women. He's not delegating this ministry to some random person who's not really up to doing anything else, so we'll just give him that role. No, he assigns this role of healing the conflict between Euodia and Syntyche. He assigns this role to someone of the highest caliber. We see the same principle elsewhere in the New Testament. I mean, you think of Stephen there in the book of Acts. And we generally perhaps link Stephen with theological brilliance and with courage, this man who was the first Christian martyr. It's fascinating, isn't it, the way that Luke describes him there in Acts 6. he tells us that the Jews from Cilicia, there in Jerusalem, the Jews from Cilicia could not stand up to the wisdom with which Stephen spoke. I think he deliberately mentions the Jews from Cilicia because that would have included Saul, who was from Tarsus. Saul would have been one of those Jews who could not stand up to the wisdom with which Stephen was speaking. Saul, the great scholar, found in Stephen someone who was even better than him, even wiser, able to outdo him. That's Stephen. He was a brilliant guy. And yet, what was Stephen's main role in the Jerusalem church? His main role was that he was appointed with six others to heal a conflict between the Jewish widows and the Greek widows and the Hebrew widows in that church. A man of such caliber, and yet the role he was assigned was that of healing a conflict. And all of this points us then to the dignity of healing conflicts. We know that from Jesus' words, don't we? Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called sons of God. Healing conflicts, it requires patience. It requires wisdom. It requires impartiality. And I'm saying that if you ever find yourself in a situation where you have the opportunity to help bring two estranged Christians back together, don't see that as beneath you somehow. Oh, I've got higher ambitions than that. Now, that is a dignified ministry. Grasp it. Because when Euodias and Syntychus are reconciled, when they come back together, heaven celebrates. Hell groans. Christ himself smiles. It's a wonderful thing when Christians are brought together. And if you can ever help that to happen, then grasp that opportunity with both hands. Amen.